Hello, my name is Rich Jones. I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and the chief clinical officer of U-Turn Health. And I'm also a co-host of this wonderful podcast.
And my name is Liz, and I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and a co-host of You Learn, You Turn.
And let's get the show on the road.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's Friday, which I'm thrilled about. I don't know what time this is going to air, but anyway, it's Friday when we're recording, so I've got Friday attitude. I've got Jeff Johnston,
yep.
Johnston with me today from Brighton, living undeterred. What else you got going on? I mean, this guy's out to save the world, but more importantly, this younger generation. And I've been following him on social media for a few years now. We were supposed to meet a few years ago. It didn't happen. He's been busy. We've been busy. But I really, you know, every week I have someone on that's lost someone to substance use disorder, had a child overdose on fentanyl, been in recovery themselves, lost a parent, lost a spouse. I hate to say he wins it all, but he does in this category because Jeff has been touched by every single one of these things. I'm not going to read your bio. I just want to welcome you to the show. Welcome to You Learn, You Turn, Jeff.
Liz, I'm really excited. It's like 9 degrees below zero here in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It's a lovely day, though. I'm looking out my window. It's great. This whole journey has been quite the enlightening, spiritual, you know, thing for me. And I look back and when this all started back when I was 50 in 2016, and then where I'm at today. And even though there's been a tremendous amount of adversity and chaos and things that, you know, I couldn't have predicted, I feel I'm a better person today than I've ever been in my entire life. And even though I've lost a lot, I've gained so much. And I'll talk a little bit about reframing and some of my, you know, old stoicism that I practiced back in college has really helped me today. Even something like death can be opportunistic. It can be a way to become better, not bitter. And it's hard to explain that to somebody. And I didn't initially feel that way. And I can kind of share my story, kind of how I've gotten to this point today. But what people probably, maybe you realize, maybe you don't, but I work really, really, really hard at staying in this zone. I mean, really hard. Like,
yeah,
I can share the one time I decided to get overconfident and think I had grief and trauma whipped, you know, almost cost me my life. I can share that. But, you know, I think when I listen to people on podcasts, and I'm an obsessive podcast person, I've watched you guys' podcast for a while. I really love what you guys are doing at U-Turn. Would want to emulate what you guys are doing in a way, you know.
Thank you.
You know, and I've followed everybody on LinkedIn that makes these great posts and stuff. And it's like, you know, there's every story has something that we can relate. Now, I understand a lot of people watching right now. You know, whether they've lost a son and a wife, you know, I don't know if they have, but there's things in their life that I can't relate to. But
yeah,
and that's the uniqueness of our own stories. And that's why it's important to be vulnerable, because I think one thing that I do sometimes fall trap to, and I know people do too, when they're in this space in recovery or whatever, is that we compare, like grief comparison, like, oh, well, Liz, you know, Liz's husband took his own life. I'm just making this up, Liz. Sorry.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can't relate to that. My story isn't as traumatic as hers. So how can I feel bad? And that's just, you know, that's not productive. I did that early on. And now it's like, you know, I want to lead with love and hope and abundance and less fear and scarcity and less comparison. Because, you know, at the end of the day, none of that is productive for me increasing my well-being. And I think being vulnerable has been something that, and I know you've shared a little bit on your LinkedIn profile, some being vulnerable. Mm-hmm. There's something about being vulnerable that's so beneficial and so gives us a sense of purpose as the one sharing the story. But hearing somebody share a story is so beautiful. And I just, you know, I feel so grateful when somebody trusts me enough to call me out of the blue. And it's almost every day. I mean, I get a text or a DM or a call and, hey, Jeff, I don't know you, but I'd like to talk to you. And I'm like, I'm just a guy from Iowa. I'm not a clinician. I don't understand any of this stuff. I just kind of do what I've been doing.
You have lived experience and, you know, sharing connects us as human beings. And I think we're all craving that in this day and age. But take us back to, I hate to do that, but take us back to 2016 and you're living your life. You've got, what, three kids, beautiful wife.
I'm literally sitting on top of the mountain. I'm 50, you know, financially done well. I mean, at 23, I had this vision of, I want to be this guy that had this business and was successful and could be charitable and travel the world and have a beautiful wife and beautiful kids and all the stuff that you see very pretentious today on social media, which we know behind the scenes as adults and most of that stuff's not true. But I was living that illusion. Well, then, so at age 50, October 4th, 2016, before the event that changed my trajectory in my life, I ran a wealth management firm called Premier Investments of Iowa that I started when I was 23, you know, 100 hours a week, slept in my car, sold insurance door to door for years, and then finally got my securities license. And we had grown the organization. So on that day, we had about $600 million of assets under management, which is larger than a lot of banks. We had 9 full-time staff and 7 employees. I had a radio show, I had a TV show. You know, I had all these things that I guess I was successful, right?
Yeah.
I mean, by definition. But what people didn't know is I was a 34-year alcoholic. I had 20-year compulsive gambling addiction that was severe. The reality was, as I was presenting this success story to the public, and behind the scenes, I was having some issues. I was, you know, up to 190 pounds, drinking 6 days a week, functional alcoholic, Liz. So I could get up in the morning, work, never drank before 5, but man, from 5 to 9, I drank it all.
Yeah.
And you know, then my oldest son, Seth, our oldest son, Seth, at 15, we took him into the doctor because he was hyper and intense and fidgeted and wow, shocking, right? That's every 15-year-old person.
Yeah.
But I took him in and if I have one regret, it's I just accepted the doctor's diagnosis that he had this stupid thing called attention deficit disorder that I allowed the doctor to give him Adderall. And, you know, my dad's a doctor. I should have bounced it off my dad, but I never did. I just trusted the system. I didn't go in there to walk out with a prescription bottle. I walked in there to walk out with a son that was happy and smiled and got a better life. And instead, he got a prescription bottle. And that turned into marijuana. It turned into drunk driving, breaking and entering, cocaine, prison. And then on that fateful day, he met fentanyl. And at 23, he was dead. So, you know, I went from being on top of the mountain, looking at which mountain I was going to conquer next, to now laying on my back on the bottom of the abyss. You know, couldn't go any further, you know, that quickly. And that whole day that Seth died was just, you know, the end of a 7-year battle that he had with all these things, you know, substance abuse, mental health, all these things. And I'm just this dad trying to coach, trying to run a business, trying to keep my wife, you know, from worrying about our son, juggling all these, and then my own health's deteriorating. And then Seth dies. And it's like, you know, death came into my life and said, okay, you know, this is a reminder that you don't have your life under as much control as you thought you did. And so I didn't think of it that way. I thought I was being punished. You know, I thought I was paying the price for being a bad dad or a bad husband. And I didn't ever heard of fentanyl. I didn't know what fentanyl was. You know, that day Seth died, I knew, Liz, that my life was never going to be the same. And the day he died was districts for my middle son, his golf. He was a competitive golfer, played college golf for a couple of years, all 4 years. But anyway, I was dropping Ian off to play and my phone rang and I looked and I knew that at 6:30 in the morning, this was going to be a bad call. And was told Seth was dead. And Ian's right here in front of me. You know, he's a sophomore. His team's over here getting ready to go to state. And I write about this in my book. And I didn't tell him. I just froze. I panicked. I thought this is not the time to bring down his team. Obviously, he couldn't golf that day if I told him. And this was districts. They'd never made state in school history. I didn't want to impede his day and all the parents and all the kids that worked hard. So I just turned around, got my car and left, never told him I loved him. You know, which is just,
you did what you had to do in that moment. You know,
I think, how is it going to tell my wife our son is dead? You know, how do you have that conversation? So I get home and, you know, she's getting all ready and she's got her hat on, her school colors. And it's like, I can't talk. I'm just shaking. And she knows something awful. And she probably knew it was Seth because this was something that we've been down the road. He just was released from prison. I said, Seth is dead. And boy, you know, I just don't remember anything after that. But I know after we went to the hotel, they had already taken him away. They had the yellow tape up just like in the movies. And I'm like, what's going on? What's going on? And then I thought, okay, now I got to tell his his younger two brothers, you know, and or 15 and 13. And they had really looked up to Seth. And so I call these dad moments, and I call these moments that you have as husband moments. You get three or four or five in your entire lifetime. And it's like, you can't drop the ball. You've got to say something impactful. So I called my dad and said, what do I tell the boys? And he said, Jeff, I know you like to talk. You like to fix things. Tell them the truth and shut your mouth. My dad's a 90-year-old doctor. He's great. And I did that. And they got home and I sat him down. I said, boys, I got some really bad news. Seth's dead. And it was a pause. My wife's over here to the right. She's a wreck. And I'm trying to show, you know, strength, the man of the house, you know, right the ship. And my middle son goes, how'd he die, Dad? Drugs? No, they knew.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, drugs. And then what happened, Liz, this was the ember. This was the spark of everything I've done since then. Was that moment in my living room. And I just knew I had to say something impactful. It's like, you know, your team's down, Super Bowl, it's halftime. What are you going to say? You know, go, it's go time. You know, you're a dad. You've trained for this. You know, you're ready. What are you going to say? And I had this vision in my head of these two roads. And this became a chapter in my book. And this became my whole presentation, my keynote talk, Living Undeterred, Better, Not Bitter. It's like the better road or the bitter road. So I stood up, I cleared my voice, and I said, boys, we have one of two roads to go down. We have one road of anger, despair, and hatred, and we'll become alcoholics and addicts ourselves. Or we have a road of inspiration, love, hope, and courage. And this is an opportunity for us to not just change our lives, but for those in our lives. I'm on the second road. I ask you to join me. And when I said it, I kind of like, wow, that came out really good because I hadn't rehearsed it. But I wanted to present this as an opportunity for the boys that we really do have the choice to take the angry road, to drink, to get on the same road, you know, that Seth was on. Or we have a choice where we could look at this as an inspirational moment that we can make our lives better and those people around us. And that's what I wanted to present to the boys. But the reality was that speech was great, but I didn't listen to it. My two boys did. They went on to do some amazing things with advocacy. But I called my business partner and said, I'm going to stay home and work on my mental health. But I just got drunk 7 days a week for a year and a half. It's all I did. It's all I did.
I'm really shocked that you had the wherewithal to even say that out loud. And I was really going to be impressed if you carried that forward from that moment on. So at least we know you're human. And so you started drinking then alcoholically, or do you think already an alcoholic?
I was a 34-year alcoholic. I've been drinking since 16 or 17 years old, probably 5-6 days a week, all the way up to that day. But I was functional. Never did drugs. I have such a competitive personality. That's what got me in trouble with gambling. I would go into a casino, $5,000, and I'd want to walk out with every penny the casino had. I didn't want to walk out with 10 or 20 or 30,000. I wanted to walk out with all of it. I knew if I did drugs, I'd want to do it all. So if you lay down some cocaine, I would push the line aside and I would just take the bag and snort that. That's who Jeff Johnston is. I knew that's why I never did drugs. I never did drugs.
A little sidebar. We just had Craig Carton on last week who did the Carton.
I know who he is.
Yeah. Boomer and Carton show. Anyway, he just got out of, he was in prison for a year for.
I saw his Netflix documentary. It's really good.
For gambling addiction. Yeah. So that is one thing I didn't touch. Thank God. I touched everything else. So might as well have. But the gambling, how did you get out of that? Just curious. Is it when you quit drinking, you quit all of that?
Yeah. So I cannot explain this. I'm fairly pragmatic. Maybe that comes from my dad. But going back to the drinking part, on December 24th, 2017, 14 months after Seth died, I looked at my wife and I saw this beautiful woman that I married deteriorating in front of my eyes. You know, she looked 70. She had a hard time even standing still, her cognitive abilities, the conversation, everything was dropping, right? As you know, Seth died and I'm trying to keep my other two boys focused on being inspired. I noticed my wife out of the corner of my eye was really struggling. So on December 24th, 2017, I remember right where I was standing, I looked in the mirror, enough's enough. I'm done. I haven't had a drop since. For me, it's been the easiest thing. It's been the easiest thing ever done in my life. I don't call myself sober because that implies I'm in a fight. I just don't drink. I just don't drink. I don't go to meetings. If I drank, Liz, then I drank. I wouldn't torture myself. I don't keep track of my days. I know what day I quit. I don't know how many days that is. I don't care. I live right now, this moment. I don't drink today. And that's all I've count. And you know, that's probably atypical for a lot of alcoholics. I don't call myself an alcoholic. I just don't drink today. It's that simple. And yeah. And so I don't know if that can help people, or if what you're doing is keeping you from drinking, then keep doing it, double down on it. But for me, I just, I quit gambling the same way. One day I walked out of a casino, I lost $10,000. And I just quit. I just stopped. I don't know how I can do that. It's not, I know if I started doing these things, I know what the outcome would be. I watched my son die. And then, you know, I haven't told your listeners this, but on June 29th, 2021, one day after my he turned 18, had his birthday. The next day, my wife died of alcoholism. She died. Yeah. So she, it was prescriptions, alcohol and grief, you know, whatever you want to call it. Seth's death is what killed her. Alcohol is just the tool.
The coping mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah. She was 46. So, you know, Liz, I went from where I started my talk on top of the mountain, pat myself on the back, how great I was, how successful I was, to now death comes in my life again, takes somebody I care about and, forces me to become better. Again, and I am grateful for death. I really am. It's hard to say, and people watching this probably think, you know, how could you be grateful for that? But I am a better human today than I ever could have been through money, through fame, through whatever. I'm grateful for death. I am. I'm not ready to go, but I'm not afraid of it. And all death would do for me right now is rob me the opportunity to do what I do. And that's our Brighton app. That's help people. That's all death would do. It would take me away from the chance to help more people. And I don't, it sounds terrible, but I don't really care about my experience. It's what I can do for other people. And, you know, after my wife died, my mom died 4 months later. It's like, The day after we put our 16-year-old cat down, it's like, I'm like, really? Yeah, I'm like, really? And I didn't drink. It's like, I never was tempted to have a drink. But I went to that Christmas. So my wife died in June. My mom died in November. And then Christmas hits and my two boys are out with friends and I'm home.
How old are your boys? what?
20 and 18.
Okay.
20 and 18. And I sat, there was these boxes in my living room after my wife died. I kept walking by them and walking by them. And finally, I just, by myself on a Friday, I sat down, pulled up a chair, and I said, you know, Liz, I'm just going to go through these boxes and see what's in them. You know, I'm Mr. Living Undeterred, right? I'm invincible. Yeah. I've been through it all. It can't get any worse. Popped open the first box, and there was just pictures of Seth, and just, I went from here to here so quick. I shut my phone off. I shut my computer off. I didn't want to talk to anybody. And I just went through this box and just like, what do I do with these things? I can't throw them out. You know, I have to do something with them. And then I thought, well, screw it. I'm going to put this box aside and I'm going to go to the next box of doom. And I opened it up and it was my wife and it was our marriage. And it was, and I went so down so fast. And 2 days went by. My business partner's wife came over. Everyone was worried about me. And I had went to my closet and I got my, opened my safe and I took my gun out. And, you know, the worst part of this whole thing is I was so comfortable in ending my life. I was just so ready to die. It's like the pain of living was so much stronger than whatever was out there ahead of me. And I got down to 3 seconds. And what people don't know is the Brighton app that we have for kids' mental health. Mm-hmm. When our son Seth died, his daughter was born 3 weeks later. And no, she's seven. Oh. And her name is Brighton.
Oh, I did not know that.
And so as I sat in my closet with I have a granddaughter and her dad died, you know, 3 weeks prior to her birth and her mom's gone. Her mom's got a bed problem. But I sat in that closet with a gun to my head thinking, I got down to 3 seconds and I just kept thinking about Brighton. And it's like, man, my kids can't lose their dad. You know, I'm undeterred, right? It's like, you know, that's what I'm trying to show them, you know? And so the only reason I share this pain with people is that, you know, people look at me, they do, they follow me and they think I'm Superman and I'm seconds away from doing that again every day. I know it. And that's why I get up at 4:45 and meditate for half an hour. That's why I work out 2 hours a day. That's why I don't watch TV. I don't follow negative things. I know I am that close to, you know, this happening again. And, I respect death enough to know that I'm in awe of death in a way because it makes life more valuable. You lose somebody. If that doesn't, I mean, the pull for alcohol is comical compared to what I've been through. It's like, I don't have any desire to drink. It's like, I'm honoring my son by not drinking. It's like,
right. Yeah.
You know, I found that thing. And that's what we all have to do is find that thing. And your thing could be you were arrested or maybe you got divorced or maybe you're bankruptcy or that thing is what keeps me alive. And it isn't the fear of death. It's,
yeah,
I want to milk every experience I can have right now. And my heart is so full of love and inspiration. And when I cry, the weight of the tears are so much different. Like when I just cried there, it's so much more of just, I'm so happy to be alive. I'm so grateful to be able to talk to you and to share this story and to, you know, just go to bed tonight and I sleep good. You know, it's just like, but I know I'm just like, I'm right there. You know, I'm right there. I don't call it triggering. I don't have depression. I don't play those narratives. I have extreme sadness.
So
I think that's what I play games in my head that I don't want to participate in these narratives that most people play. And it works for me.
You're amazing in your strength. I just have to say, like, my path has been a lot different, but I hear you when you say it's that thing that keeps you We had a near-death experience as well 17 years ago, which is what drove me here and drives my passion. And when I look back, I mean, no, I would never trade the things that we went through that were terrible to get me to where I am today. So I can understand, even if someone out there can't, when you say death is not a gift, but it's something that's changed your life and you wouldn't have it any other way. And well, you didn't say that. I guess you would have it.
No, but I know what you mean. It's
a gift. These awful things are a gift and you just want to share it with the world. And I can tell you, I can feel it through the computer. I can feel your emotions. I can see it in your face. I can see the pain, but also the joy of living because you've seen both sides. You've even almost been there, you know, yourself. So, take me. Okay. So that was the Christmas and you were going through the boxes. You did not leave this world. Thank God. And then how did you start your tour? Was that the next process?
No, the tour. Yeah. The tour was after that. Cause I did the tour in 2022. So that was in the summer in May. So I came up with the idea late 2021. So yeah, I came up with the idea of the tour right about the time my wife died. Matter of fact, she never knew about the tour. I had not told her about it yet. But yeah, so the tour idea was just, I got tired of being on social media and copying and pasting and liking and sharing and just kind of, you know, I don't mean this to be insulting because I play all the algorithm narratives that you can, but it's like sometimes you just vomit over each other with accolades of how great people are. And it's like, you know, I like that too when people tell me all that, but at some point I just felt like, okay, enough's enough. Like I looked in the mirror and quit drinking. I got to do something different.
Right.
And so I just, and this is a true story. I grabbed a bunch of my books. This is my book right here. So that's my son, Seth. It's called This One's For You. And an inspirational story. Let's see, an inspirational journey through addiction, death, and meaning. And,
the show notes. Fantastic.
Yeah. So I wrote this a couple years after Seth died, before my wife died. But I went up to Camping World in Cedar Falls with about 10 books, walked in, said, hey, I want to buy an RV, drive around the United States. Will you guys help me? And so, yeah, they worked out a pretty good deal. And I walked out that day with a 34-foot brand new Hurricane Thor. I'd never been in an RV in my entire lifetime.
Are you kidding?
No, never that day. Got it that day. I went to LinkedIn, showed a picture of it, told everyone I'm doing a tour, and I told my boys, now we can't back out. Now we got to do it. We got
to
do it.
I didn't even know how to drive an RV. You just drove it right off the lot?
We did. I drove it home. I never drove one before. The guy drove me around town a little bit. I test drove it, and then we drove it home. I went to a place in here, got it fully wrapped, you know, and my dream was to go around the United States and wave this banner of, you know, mental health initiative and rah, 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 and corporate America, and people would be throwing all this stuff at me to help me, but no, it's crickets. It was so demoralizing to be driving around in this RV. I had one corporation reach out to support me. I wanted to raise $1 million. I raised $30,000. I spent $150,000 of my own money, not counting the RV. And I was sitting in KOAs at night crying, you know, with my boys going, you know, what are we doing? And they're like, Dad, you're living undeterred. And I'm like, yeah, but what's the end game? What am I trying to do? And they're like, Dad, you're trying to help people. And I'm like, I know, but where's the help? Where are the people that always say they're going to help? And I have to think CEOs are driving by my RV every day. Where are they?
Right.
So I said, screw it. I'm going to build an app. I'm just going to do it myself. I'm just going to build it. I'm from Iowa. You build it, they come. That's Field of Dreams. That was the whole premise of Field of Dreams. So I decided on a 3 a.m. on a KOA amidst tears that I was just going to hire a group in DC to build an app for me. And I don't know nothing. I know nothing about technology. I know nothing about startup companies. And I went to LinkedIn, hired a full-time employee. Her name's Emily and she's with me today. She's awesome. Hired a company in DC to build it. And, I may go broke. I don't care. I don't really care. I just figured, you know what? I've already asked for help. I've went around the country, put 20,000 miles on. Nobody really helped me. I had a few groups help me. I'd sit here and name a few, but yeah, I had some support, but nothing like I thought I would do. So I could sit around and cry and feel sorry for myself and be on the bitter road, or I could just get better, step up my game. So that's what I'm doing. That's the whole idea behind the Brighton app is a founder that's, I'm not going to be stopped. I don't know. People ask me all the time, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? And it's like, I'm just in motion. I'm just in moving. That's my therapy, Liz, is I have to be always moving.
Tell us you do. And a lot of times that's what fuels creativity. That's what fuels productivity. And it sounds like I actually downloaded the Brighton app today. And one thing I was surprised at, it's not just about mental health, but what I loved about it was it's financial, because a lot of times these young people, I know a lot of my daughter's friends are in a lot of financial trouble in their mid-20s.
Yeah.
They don't even know how to balance a checkbook. They don't write checks. They only do Venmo. So they were really good, like everyday living things that can help these young kids. But tell us the genesis of the app and what it does and who it's used for.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you are giving me a chance to talk about this, because I did a lot of recon. So even though I'm pretty impulsive, I did do some recon on what was out there. And I didn't want to be a telehealth app, because I have this philosophical problem. If you have a child, Liz, and they're on my app, and I diagnose you on some CBT-based assessment that you have attention deficit, I'm going to send you to a therapist, and they walk out with Adderall. It's like, that's what I'm trying to avoid. That's what I'm trying to avoid. Now, the money's there, venture capital money, they love that. But you know what? I don't care about that right now. I care about what happened in my family started with Adderall, started with a prescription given for attention deficit. So why would I build an app where the whole goal was to send other people's kids to go see the same situation that Seth went through?
Right.
That's not saying that telehealth isn't going to be an off-ramp on our app. It will be. We'll have the ability to help kids. But that's not my unique, you know, competitive advantage is to be telehealth. So I didn't want to be treatment. I didn't really want to be prevention, because prevention's fear-based. You know, Liz, if I say to you, don't do drugs, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Phew, that's uplifting.
Yeah.
You know, so there's nothing in there. So we invented the new category called empowerment mental wellness. And so we're not treatment. We're not prevention. We're empowerment. So everything in our app is uplifting. We don't have users even. We have thrivers. We don't call the people on our, we are so intentional. Every word that they see is going to be inspirational. So our young adults are called thrivers. So we have a community of thrivers. That's what we have. We don't have users. Why would I call a user for my app when my son died using drugs? Really? I mean, that to me is like an insult. So that was just a no-brainer. So what I did was this. I thought, okay, if I could be the creator for a day and create an optimal 20-year-old, okay, what would that person look like? Right?
Yeah.
So another way to ask the question is, what are the top three things that kids today stress about? What are the three things that are the biggest issues? So I did this tremendous amount of recon. I mean, read and podcasts. I probably listened to some of your guys' podcasts a year ago. I tried
to. Can I try to guess?
What's that?
Can I try to guess the top three?
Yeah.
Okay. Body image.
Okay. Well, go ahead. I'll let you go through the ones, and then I think they fit in.
Okay. Well, I'm just thinking about 20 somethings I know is body image, financial status, or finances, like how to get money, how to save money, how to use money. And the third would be the biggest worry or concern. Well, body image would be an inclusiveness. So like finding your people. I don't know the third one. Those two are so big.
I struggled too. I struggled with three.
What is it? I'm sure I got it all right.
Okay.
What is it?
I'll go back a little bit. So when I was a financial advisor, you came in my office, you gave me your 401k. I invested it for you based on a financial plan, right? So I didn't just throw darts at stocks. We had a plan. Well, the plan then would say, let's diversify your money into stocks, bonds, and real estate. Well, when I got into mental health, I noticed there's nothing like that. There's no plan, and there's no diversification. It's just a game of whack-a-mole. your kid's having a problem. Let's go see a doctor. We'll give a prescription for that problem. And then when another problem comes up, we'll go run at that problem. You know, we'll focus on diet. And so it's just, or sleep. Let's focus on your sleep. And so there's this big game of mental health whack-a-mole. And I thought, okay, I'm a good financial advisor. What could I do to, you know, create an app on mental health for kids based on my experiences as an advisor? And I thought, well, let's diversify their mental health. Let's diversify their mental wellness. And so I came up with three asset classes. So a set of stocks, bonds, and real estate. It's health, wealth, and purpose. And how I came up with those was this. So you talked about body image. That's health. So health is mindfulness, yoga, stretching, exercise, diet, sugar intake, caffeine, you know, blah, blah. That's all health.
Okay.
That was easy. Every app out there has that. So I thought, okay, what's the second one? And I started looking at research in Gen Z. They're the most lost generation of all time. They're upset with what adults have done to the climate. They have no discussions on politics. They're all angry. Mom and dad argue about Trump and Biden. Pollution in the water. Student debt. It's like there's no purpose. They're lacking meaning and purpose. And so they're the most lost generation of all time. And they're also the world's largest generation. So that was my second one, health and purpose. And I thought, what's three? And it's right in front of me. It's wealth. And that was what I did for 34 years. So I figured, okay, let me look at the stats. Number one stressor for older Gen Z, 18 to 26, is financial insecurity. Now there's a difference there. It's their confidence level. It's their relationship with money. So we're not talking about how to make money. That's not what our Brighton curriculum is about. It's how do you develop a better relationship with money? 7% of college kids today are addicted to gambling. And it's because of the online gambling on the phones they can do now. 87% of those, I think, are men or males. So that's never addressed in any mental health. I'd sit there, Liz, and I'd go to LinkedIn Live conferences with 100 people. All these experts. And I'd sit there going, no one talks about a healthy relationship with money. It's all, you know, it's all good stuff, you know, suicide awareness and, you know, body image stuff and meaning and purpose. But there's that elephant in the room for me as a financial advisor was, why don't we showing these kids? They're telling us the largest concern is financial insecurity. Where's an app that has all three of these on one app? And then the other thing that solidified it for me was 67% of American adults live paycheck to paycheck. So where are kids? They lack the confidence. Majority of parents are broke. Where are they getting this at? They're getting the math behind the money at school. They're getting the quantitative aspects, but not the qualitative, not the emotion behind money. So our curriculum is all based on a respect, a reverence towards wealth creation. And then when you do create it, how can we give back? So we're talking a lot about charitable stuff with kids, teaching them how to give back when they do well. And that all ties together. So going back to the design, health, wealth, and purpose, if I can get kids to work on this daily, like I work on my stuff daily, I am so convinced that we can get a subset of young adults to not just improve their mental health or their mental wellness, but to give back, become the next level of advocates, to be the next recovery experts, to be the next people on podcasts like me sharing their stories of how they were depressed or they had a gun to their head. And now they're doing better and they can share that success. And I want to give them a chance. I mean, this generation, we beat them down. All we do is we tell them all the problems with them. But I want to crack that door just a little bit and then get the hell out of the way.
Yeah.
Let them become autonomous and self-assess. And let them, you know, create their own destiny and not be the ones that they're going, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Now, that's not what Brighton's about. We don't tell them on our app anything what not to do. You know, things that we need to get better at is on our app right now, we don't really have a lot of off ramps yet to help those that are in crisis mode, but we're actively trying to get that implemented. That's a big part.
I was going to say, do you have, a community on there? Are you allowed to have community and share with one another? Do you have peer support? Is all this coming in the future?
Yeah, our MVP just coming to market. That was not a must have. That's a want to have. We complete our pre-seed round, which that could happen literally any day, which would be great. Then we would implement that, that community feature. Right now we have some, you know, some aspects of a community feature, but we don't have the chat rooms and all that stuff. But yeah, that, that's just a no brainer to have a youth mental empowerment app. You have to have the ability for them to be able to connect with each other.
And what I love about this is it's not, you know, like U-Turn Health, we typically help people. They're usually kind of on a downward slide. Some people not. They just want to refocus their life. But what you're doing with these young kids is saying, you know, you don't have to be at rock bottom to need a little guidance. This Brighten app is here for you, for your mental health, also just how to live life, like a little instruction book on how to do life with health, wealth, and health, purpose, and wealth.
Health, wealth, purpose. Health, wealth, purpose.
With those three areas in your life covered, you won't have to go down that downward spiral. And you don't have to be stressed about finances all the time, which leads to depression and anxiety, which leads to substance use disorder. So you're sort of nipping it in the bud by being proactive and addressing these things that that really do affect these kids. And I know, like I said, I have two 20-something-year-olds, and they do tend to be some of the most stressed, anxious people. But I can't say I blame them. Not only have they grown up on technology, which is known to create synapses that make you anxious and your cortisol levels always rise, but the world is hard, man. It's tough out here. It's tough out here for a 54-year-old woman.
It's tough for a 57-year-old male.
You don't make it seem tough, Jeff. I tell you,
I do.
Oh my God, the things you've been through and your attitude, better, not bitter. I love it. And there was something else you had on your LinkedIn page that you posted the other day. And it was when you find your, it's a quote by you.
It's my quote, purpose becomes passion when it gets personal. And that's right. That's what we're telling all of our thrivers is, you know, and I try to teach kids how to find their purpose, because you can sit around and wait for purpose to happen. You know, death came into my life to show me purpose. You know, you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait for someone to die. So how do you find purpose? Okay. This is an easy exercise for any young adult watching this, that, or any adult for that matter, that wants to find their purpose. So you take that phrase, you write it down. Purpose becomes passion when it gets personal, and then do it backwards. So think of something personal. Okay. For me, I lost a son to fentanyl, lost my wife to alcohol and grief. You know, I was a compulsive gambler. Those are all personal things in my bubble. Okay. So go backwards. Purpose becomes passion when it gets personal. Find something personal, make it your passion. So that's what I did. I wrote a book. I didn't know anything about fentanyl. I wrote a book. I started a podcast. I didn't have my podcast before Seth died. I did my tour. I mean, these are all things I did to bet on my passion, to learn more. I got on podcasts. I meet people like you. I'm a sponge. I want to take from everybody and learn, and then, you know, extrapolate that data and put it into my own systems, and then go out and try to do what I can to help people. And so I think if you take that sentence, purpose becomes passion when it gets personal, focus on something personal, make it your passion. Voila. Now it's your purpose. And so when I talk to kids, instead of sitting around looking at your computer, waiting for your purpose to just show up magically, like the clouds are going to part and you're going to be anointed. Here's your purpose. Now find something personal, because even a 7-year-old has something personal.
Right.
And then immerse yourself learning about that personal thing. You know, I had a 12-year-old neighbor girl that saw an animal get abused, and she's very interested in animal welfare. So she took a personal event, an abuse of an animal, and now she's learning about what a veterinarian does and about humane societies and things like that. And now she's at 7, 8 years old, working on that ember in her heart that now can grow into a fire, and she'll be unstoppable. And that's what we got to tell kids is, hey, we all have an ember. We all do. Yeah. You do. I do. Sometimes it's just flickering. And my ember was flickering in that closet when I got down to 3 seconds. And it didn't get extinguished. I didn't pull the trigger, and I'm here. And now it's like, I feel unstoppable. But I also know I'm fallible. I mean, it doesn't take long for me to go from here to here. I mean, it can be like that. So I just really focus on not taking shortcuts either. And so for anybody who goes to AA or anybody who, you know, is in your community, because your peer-to-peer part of your app is phenomenal. I think you guys are onto something worth its weight in gold, the way you guys have built this, you know, social proof peer-to-peer aspect of U-Turn. But, you know, there's something about that. There's some beauty in all that, you know, amidst all this, this chaos and negativity. But, and that's what keeps me going, is that little spark, you know, and, I just want to always make sure that there's an ember in there, you know, at some point. And
I know that you say that the tour and all that was, you know, you were upset and you didn't feel supported, but what I heard was your boys looking at a dad who could be groveling in grief, drinking himself to death, and instead took a chance, took an RV, and they will never forget seeing you do that.
Yeah.
The most important people in the world saw what you did. Who cares what the CEOs did?
Yeah. The worst moment on the tour is now like the most memorable moment on the tour. And that was a day in Arkansas in Little Rock where I got asked to speak at Wolf Street Recovery Community Center. Mm-hmm. And the night before, I don't know if you know who they are, but they're great. And that night before, I got an email from Rotary, where the president of the Rotary International Action Group for Addiction Prevention wanted to come hear me talk because they were going to ask me to be on their board. And I thought, this is great. Yeah, I'm a Rotarian. This is great. Uh-huh. It's great for our everything we're doing. And so that morning, you know, it's like 10 o'clock. My talk's at like 3. You know, we're getting ready and 11 o'clock hits. My son and I are getting ready and we take off the RV in the KOA and I tear off the awning. I forgot to put the awning in the night before.
Oh my God.
Because I spent an hour talking to a nurse that got off work and she was next to us and we were talking about COVID and all this mental health stuff and I just forgot. And so I'm like, oh my, are you kidding me? You know, I got to give a talk in front of 100 people. I got the president of Rotary coming down and I tear the awning off. And my son's like, well, Dad, let's figure it out. So we put some bungee cords and I called Camping World. They're like, well, we're not going to come there. We're not going to put men up on, you have to bring it to us. So I put in my phone, you know, Camping World, and we're driving down the interstate going like 25 miles an hour. The awning's just hanging out there and I'm sweating. The air's not working in an RV. It's 102 degrees. I've got, you know, 2.5-3 hours to go for my talk. I'm driving down and all of a sudden, the bungee cords broke or whatever. And the awning just flies out like a Chevy Chase movie. And I'm going 35 down the interstate. And if there had been a car next to me, I would have hit them. And I don't know what would have happened, but the RV went like this, refrigerator opened, all the food went spilling out. Make a long story short, two people came, unbelievably. We cut the RV off. The awning off. I paid him cash. I didn't care. I had to get to the meeting. They took the awning with them. I got to the meeting, signed the contract, a 5-year board member deal. It was one of my best talks I ever did. And the moral of the story is that even at the moment when I thought I wasn't going to make it, I always had that ember burning. There was always that chance I was going to get there and I was not going to give up. And that's one day on tour. It happens to be kind of the funniest story.
I mean, I hate to say, I wish I had that on film, but I wish I had that on film. That's can't make that stuff up.
I have a ton of footage. I'm doing a documentary next summer on the tour and I just haven't had time to go through it all, but I have a lot of really cool stories like that.
But, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this has just been a joy, not to hear the sadness in your story, but just your resilience is, man, it's amazing. If anyone is lost or hopeless today, I hope you hear this talk and just get that ember lit in you, because life is not over because death comes knocking. In mm-hmm. fact, it may be just your time to give life to someone else. And that's what you've done, Jeff Johnston. And I really appreciate you and appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. And I will be following along with Brighton. I will link it in the show notes as well as the book you've written. Look forward to your documentary. And when will you get your podcast back up and running?
It's a good question. It was hard for me to, in October, I just told my team things were going really fast with Brighton. I was, as you know, with startups, and I just said, I want to come back and do a podcast down the road, but right now it's just not the best use of my time because I met some great people.
Sure.
So I'm going to redo it, but we're going to rebrand it where it's going to be more youth mental wellness instead of the Living Undeterred podcast where I would basically talk to anybody about resiliency.
Yeah.
Now it's going to be more bringing on young adults that have been through horrific and heroic things that they can share to our Brighton audience as we build the Brighton community out,
Well, I'm just really glad for one. And I know you're out there fighting for this generation coming up because they need it. Their mental health needs it. And if there's anything we can do at U-Turn Health to help you, let us know. Like we were talking before the podcast, if we could all just band together and work together and instead of staying so siloed, I think we could save a lot more lives and touch a lot more people. So we are here for you. And we're in your corner. And thank you for sharing from your heart. You're just amazing, amazing that you can tell that story and that you're still here. And not only are you still here, you're still smiling. So
I will say, if anybody out there watching this, because I know you talk a lot in the recovery space and people that are really struggling.
Yeah.
I have a saying that I like. I have quite a bit of sayings, but in the book, I have a whole bunch of quotations and stuff, things that help me get through. But I have something real simple, and I got this from Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, which is the best book I've ever read in my life in regards to just it's Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And he was a prisoner in Auschwitz and how he came out of it. And then just, I think Man's Search for Meaning is one of the most five read books of all time. There's the Bible, there's some other things.
And it's,
it is anybody watching this, just read it, whether you actually read it or Audible, I don't care. But, and there was, I remember the moment I came across that quote that he said, "Suffering is my opportunity." And I just shut the book and I thought, I remember exactly where I was. I'm like, oh my gosh, isn't that the most amazing, most beautiful, poignant sentence I've ever heard in my life? Is suffering is my opportunity. That's why when I say now death came into my life as an opportunity, I got that from Viktor Frankl. And I thought, well, I can't use that quote. I'm just going to come up with my own. So I came up with this. Pain is unavoidable. Suffering is a choice. And so pain, Seth died. That frickin' hurt. It still hurts. My wife died. That hurts. Mom dying, that hurts. But the suffering that I attach to that event is my choice. That is my choice. Mm-hmm. I've got that ember burning inside of me. I want to live the rest of my 30, 40 years still left with the best lived experience I can. I can't do it impeding it with alcohol and drugs and negativity and anger and hatred and jealousy and all that. And so I choose to be better. Doesn't mean I don't have mercy and grace and I allow myself to cry. When I cry, Liz, I freaking cry. I'm a first team All-American crier.
Good for you. I love it.
And matter of fact, I cry so much, my black lab comes across the room and I have to push him away. I'm not done yet. Leave me alone. Because he wants to help me. And I'm like, no, I want to cry. It's like a mental health workout. I tell people all the time, when's the last time you ever cried in your entire lifetime, a good cry, and felt worse?
That is so true.
Never. It's not that possible.
Yeah.
So when you're sitting there and you're struggling and maybe you had a drink, maybe you had a 2-year sobriety run and you had a drink and you're just like killing yourself and you're just like, just cry, let it out. You're going to feel better. It's your mental health workout, go exercise, do something. But, one thing I've said too to kids when I speak at high schools is, write down on a piece of paper the single worst thing that's ever happened to you in your entire lifetime, event, moment, or memory. You've survived it. You made it here. So you've survived 100% of every worst thing that's ever happened to you. What makes you think you can't do the next? Well, you can. I mean, if I can, I'm normal. You can too. It's like, and that's the mindset we got to tell these kids and quit telling them what not to do. Quit telling them, don't do drugs. Don't do that. they're going to do these things anyway. Fentanyl, I know, changed the landscape. Now you don't get a second chance. I get that. Maybe there's a little bit more inspiration behind telling kids not to do drugs. Maybe that's not the best analogy for me, but the reality is fear and scarcity has never, will never change the world. Prohibition won't get people to stop doing things. So we know that. What's the next thing? Empowerment. That's where I think the future is of mental health. And you guys do that through your communities, through your peer-to-peer. I mean, I just signed up. I'm a new customer for you guys. So I downloaded your app and I'm going to, I probably anonymously will jump in some of your meetings and just kind of see how they go. And I can always benefit from hearing other people share and community. And so I'm happy what you guys do. And I'm honored to have this chance to talk to you and whatever I can do to support U-Turn as well. You can count on Brighton, the team at Brighton. We're all about trying to, we got into this mess together. We're going to get out of it together, right?
That's right. That's right. Wow. Well, thank you so much. And I will, what's the name of that book that you just said? I've already forgotten it.
Man's Search for Meaning.
Man's Search for Meaning. Yeah. I heard that on a podcast recently. This guy said, you've got to go read that book. I mean, it really will put everything in perspective for you. So anyway, Jeff Johnston, thank you so much for joining us. I will link your Brighton app as well. And people can sign up for that. You don't have to have a code or...
It's free right now. And I will tell you that our new dev team, the new upgrades are complete. So the app you see right now in about a week or two, it's going to be substantially better and different. So it's free right now. We do have a tiered subscription coming in probably around March, but anyone that has it will be grandfathered in. And so, yeah.
All right. Well, we will link all that and put it on social. So anyway, great to finally meet you. I'm sorry it's taken us a couple of years, but let's keep in touch and maybe we'll have you back on and get an update.
That'd be great. Yeah, I'd love to have you meet our team and see if we can save the world together.
I'd love that. Everybody out there from You Learn, You Turn, great to have you here and listening, and everyone have a wonderful weekend.